A dispute between the president and military leadership spills out into public.
It has undermined military discipline. It has undermined the law of armed conflict. And I think more significantly, it has put U.S. troops on the level of our enemy.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 25th, we'll break down the unprecedented story behind the forced resignation of a Navy secretary. Also on the show, newspapers across the country are being forced out of business. Do you subscribe to your local outlet?
I do not subscribe to my local newspaper.
I subscribe and I have for years.
Although I do get my national, international news online, for some reason I don't do the same for my local paper.
We'll start with the situation with the Navy right now. In the latest sign of recent tensions between the Trump administration and the military, Navy Secretary Richard V. Spencer resigned from his post on Sunday after Defense Secretary Mark Esper demanded that he step down. Spencer's resignation stemmed in large part from the case of the Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher. Earlier this year, a military court convicted Gallagher for posing for a photograph with the corpse of a 17-year-old ISIS captive. Gallagher was acquitted on charges of shooting civilians and murdering a captive Islamic State fighter. After Gallagher's conviction, the Navy demoted him. But earlier this month, President Trump reversed that decision, setting off what many say is an unprecedented display of exercising presidential authority over a legal military decision. President Trump and Navy Secretary Spencer openly disagreed over whether the Navy would reverse course and investigate Gallagher further. On Sunday afternoon, Defense Secretary Mark Esper declared that he had lost trust in Spencer's leadership and was asking for the secretary's resignation. Esper was saying that Spencer had attempted to make a side deal with the White House to restore Gallagher's rank. By Sunday evening, in a letter to President Trump, Secretary Spencer said, quote, "I no longer share the same understanding with the commander-in-chief who appointed me in regards to the key principle of good order and discipline." I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining me now is Leo Shane III, the deputy editor at Military Times. Leo, welcome to the program.
Thanks for the invitation.
Also with us is Gary Solis, a military lawyer and retired professor from West Point, and a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who spent 17 months as a combat arms officer in Vietnam. Gary, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Gary, we'll start with you. The latest news is obviously the resignation of Navy Secretary Richard V. Spencer. How significant is this in your opinion?
Well, it's very significant. I can't think of the last time that SecNav has been fired, but Spencer is a retired Marine, and regardless of the merits of his of his case, he should know that you don't go to the general without clearing it with your colonel, and now he's having that dictum reinforced.
And we'll get a little bit into the conflicting reports we heard about how this happened. But I'm wondering, Gary, if you had any thoughts on the resignation letter itself. And I'll just read you one line that really stood out to us was, and I'm quoting Spencer here. He says, "I no longer share the same understanding with the commander-in-chief who appointed me in regards to the key principle of good order and discipline."
Yes, I think that that's a very good point. And I think it goes to the heart of what the Gallagher case has become. I think that we are now beyond Gallagher and we're into military-civil relationships. And it's very unusual for the president to take such an active interest in such a really insignificant case. At least it's become an insignificant case in terms of the legal issues involved. It's been decided, but it's taken on an entirely new coloration that is very significant for the country and for the military, in my opinion.
Well, and you know, Gary, we've talked a lot about the relationship between President Trump and the military and how the president could be seen as undermining the military. Do you think that these latest developments paint that picture more clearly?
I think there's no doubt in the world that he has undermined military discipline, the military justice system. He's undermined command authority in the military, and he has done a disservice to the military by his disregard to the command system.
Leo, initially there were conflicting reports. One was a report that Spencer was prepared to step down if President Trump interfered with the disciplinary process against Edward Gallagher. And now we're hearing that Defense Secretary Mark Esper demanded that Spencer resign after finding out that Spencer basically went behind his back to try and strike a deal with the White House. What do you make of those conflicting reports?
Yeah, just a lot of confusion right now as to exactly what went down and what's to blame here. As Gary referenced, this is a individual case that has gotten a lot of attention in conservative circles, but has now turned into a full-blown scandal for the Trump administration and a pretty big headache here. So bottom line is that a Navy secretary who was a pick of President Trump and an ally of President Trump is out of a job over the handling of this one military criminal case. However you want to slice it, that's at the heart of this. Without Trump deciding to intervene, it's hard to see how Spencer ends up out of a job.
You all cover the military. That's what you do every day. When you look at the relationship between the Trump administration and the military, what does this latest story tell us about that relationship?
Trump has always enjoyed pretty high favorability rating among troops, although we've seen in our own polling that that number has slipped over the last few years. It'll be really interesting to see what the long-term reaction is. You know, we're hearing a pretty big spread right now. Folks who saw this case and the other two cases that involve pardons as really cases where they wanted the president to intervene, that maybe the military justice system wasn't fair to these guys. But a lot of folks who see it as really concerning, especially in this Gallagher case, this is more than just issuing a pardon. This is the president intervening and saying, no, you can't demote him for conduct unbecoming. You can't remove his SEAL trident. You can't kick him out of the SEALs. You know, really micromanaging to a level that we haven't seen from the commander in chief before, and taking this one case to an unprecedented height.
Gary, is that micromanagement that Leo's describing part of the commander in chief, i.e., the president's purview?
Well, it's within his authority, but just because he can doesn't mean he should. And I think that this is a great example of that axiom. Certainly he can do it, but no president has ever done it before. Well, actually, Kennedy set aside one case of disrespect to the president in 1962. But other than that, there has been in modern times no case that I'm aware of where the president has dipped down into the daily workings of the military justice system to put his thumb on the scale.
Now, Leo mentioned the two other officers who the president pardoned a little over a week ago. There's been, Gary, a lot of debate within the military community about that decision by President Trump. What are you hearing about those other cases?
Well, I have a lot of friends that remain in the military, and I'm often a speaker at various places, military places. And I have yet to run into an officer who has agreed with the course taken by the president. Goldstein and Lawrence were, in my opinion, clearly guilty, and in the opinion of the court, in Lawrence's case, guilty. And there was simply no basis, no legal basis for the president to become involved in the first place, and certainly not to pardon them, in my opinion.
Leo, in general, I mean, we see the president, this is the third time the president has intervened in something like this. Why do you think the president pardoned these officers? And just to follow that, what do you think the role of the conservative media has been in the narrative about these pardons so far?
Well, those two things are inherently connected here. What happened with these cases is each of them became a cause celebrity amongst certain conservative groups. And what appears to have happened is the president is listening to some outside advisors who have convinced him that these were miscarriages of justice rather than folks within the military who are connected to the military justice system. You know, as Gary referenced, in Clint Lawrence's case, he was convicted of second-degree murder by a military tribunal, by military court, sentenced to 20 years and was serving out that sentence. And there's quite a few folks in conservative circles who decided that they didn't like that he shouldn't be punished for these cases. These were two Afghan insurgents who may or may not have retaliated against them. Lots of questions there, but you know, military justice system rendered a ruling, and the president said, "No, I've decided that I have more facts than that extensive court case did."
And Leo, in cases like this, it's been fellow military members who have flagged the criminal behavior of their officers, their fellow officers, and have testified against them during court proceedings. What does it mean for them, sort of pivoting back to what Gary was saying in terms of this being unprecedented, what does it mean for them that the president then basically bypasses that and issues these pardons?
Yeah, I mean, you've got three folks who've gotten clemency here, but you've got a number of folks who testified against them, were prepared to testify against them, who now are left wondering why the president went against them. I'm sure there's some concerns about what it means for their careers now if these guys are being held up as acceptable or as heroes in some circles. That paints them as the villains, and that's a big concern for a lot of these folks. And a concern among other folks that it'll have a chilling effect in the future, that, you know, that troops will be less willing to come forward and report wrongdoing if they think the president's just going to intervene and wave it off.
Gary, what is this? What do these pardons tell us about the standard rules of engagement when it comes to the military?
As Leo has suggested, it undermines them. More than simply the rules of engagement, the law of armed conflict, which is what I taught at West Point before retirement, it has undermined military discipline. It has undermined the law of armed conflict. And I think more significantly, it has put U.S. troops on the level of our enemy. I mean, our allies are going to say, "Well, you know, we can't get a conviction when we have witnesses, and when we get a conviction, it's set aside. How can we depend on our allies, the Americans, to do that which they should on the battlefield? We are supposed to be the good guys, and we have, by these cases, by the dismissing, by the pardoning of these cases, we are brought down to the level of our enemy, and that's something that's going to be a long time to overcome."
And do you think this compromises the U.S.'s the U.S. military's moral high ground? Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it has done. We have lost the moral high ground. How can we go to our allies and say, "Now remember, you can't kill unarmed civilians," and they just look at us and laugh and say, "Have you heard of the Goldstein or Gallagher or Lawrence cases?" And that is a harm to the national reputation, to the morale of the armed forces. That is a shame.
Leo, are there concerns that this decision, or these cases, I should say, threaten our national security, whether that's by losing senior staff to resignations, as we've seen with Spencer, or whether that's by pardoning members of the military who've been convicted of war crimes? Do either of those lessen or weaken our national security here?
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me a few days ago if I thought senior staff would end up resigning over this, I probably would have said no. But now we've got, now we've lost the Navy Secretary over this, and we'll see just how far-reaching the after effects are. You know, in the last few days, Senator Jack Reed, who's the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, he took to the Senate floor to talk about this, and that was one of the points he raised. He said, "Look, this is bad, not just for the military, but for all of America, because it makes our troops less safe overseas." As Gary said, how can our allies, you know, take us seriously when they see cases like this? And frankly, how can we expect our enemies to follow the Geneva Convention and other rules of war if they see U.S. troops being pardoned for these sort of things?
Leo Shane III is the deputy editor at Military Times, and Gary Solis is a military lawyer and retired professor from West Point. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been a tough decade for the American press. News publishers have struggled to adapt to a fractured media landscape. Near daily charges of fake news have undermined faith in the institution of journalism. And for many people in the United States, social media platforms have replaced traditional outlets as their primary source of news. The crisis has made headlines as high-profile digital outlets like BuzzFeed and Vice laid off significant portions of their newsrooms in 2019, and news sites like Think Progress, Splinter, and more have gone away entirely. It's not just digital journalism that's struggling to stay afloat. In the past 15 years, more than 2,000 newspapers have been forced out of business. As internet giants like Google and Facebook suck up the advertising revenue that historically kept most newspapers in business, buyouts and mergers have left many local outlets in danger of extinction. The McClatchy Company, the publishing giant behind papers like the Miami Herald and dozens of others, is reported to be on the brink of bankruptcy, and newspapers that do survive often wind up consolidated under single ownership. Joining me now to discuss the state of local media are Ken Doctor, a media analyst and founder of Newsonomics, and Penny Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Penny, many parts of the country have been described as news deserts. Tell us what that means.
Well, I think a news desert is an area that lacks access to good, quality, and credible local news. We have seen the disappearance not only of more than a fourth of our newspapers over the last 15 years, we've seen a decrease of more than a half of the journalists we had in newsrooms, especially newspaper newsrooms, at the same time. So we see a general lack of access to good, credible local news.
Now, where are we seeing these news deserts the most? Are there certain communities, certain areas in the country that are more affected than others?
There most certainly are. They tend to be communities that are struggling economically, that have much older residents, exactly the sort of communities, whether you're talking about inner city neighborhoods, whether you're talking about suburbs or even rural areas, that really need the information that news outlets, local news outlets, especially newspapers, have traditionally provided that help them make good decisions about quality of life decisions.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the quality of life decisions, because when you lose that, I think a lot of folks aren't, maybe may not be aware of what type of reporting these local outlets are doing. We're talking about people going to community board meetings, right?
We're talking about a whole range of things. We're talking about just the routine coverage of government meetings, everything from the zoning board to the school board meeting that affect the quality of the life decisions that you need to make on a day-to-day basis. But the FCC put together a list of 8 critical information needs that anybody needs in order to make good decisions. They included everything on from information on the environment, on health, on education, as well as governance and politics.
Ken, what is filling the void in these news desert communities? We mentioned at the top that people are getting their news from Facebook and Twitter. Is that enough?
Well, and they're getting it. Those are the distribution modes. But as we know, Facebook and Twitter don't create news. So all they do is recirculate whatever's out there. But people do mistake it for a source. It's not a source. If you look at it broadly, as Penny has said, we've lost probably 30,000 journalists over the last 20 years. And I'd say we have replaced them with maybe a tenth of that. And these are small groupings of journalists who have gotten together, oftentimes those that are bought out or laid off in small groups. So in a sense, very little has replaced that. In a sense, local news to a lot of people means TV news, and that's the half-hour news that is you know, traffic accidents and weather and an occasional in-depth story once a week. But that becomes the news, and I think people lose that muscle memory of deep local news.
Let's talk a little bit about the business here. I mean, there, obviously, 30,000 journalists is a lot of journalists to lose and not replace. Some of that is also because of economic pressure. We mentioned Gannett, the parent company of more than 100 daily newspapers. The New Media Investment Group, which is the owner of the newspaper chain Gatehouse Media, just finalized plans for a merger. Will that affect the media landscape?
It will, and it has. This company now, and it'll still be called Gannett, although the old company, Gannett, goes away, will manage and control a fifth of American newspapers, one-fifth, which is unprecedented. These used to be locally owned. They got chained up in the 70s and 80s, but they were still very diverse in their ownership. What we are seeing, what drives this deal is quote-unquote synergies, and that means lots of cutting. We saw the first cutting, in fact, Friday. And the whole idea here is, can these companies come together to save money, not to immediately reinvest in journalism, but to save money and then maybe figure out a plan for the future? So it's not a hopeful sign. It's just another sign of cutting. And that's what we've seen through this whole decade, which is really disinvestment.
And these aren't just smaller outlets. I mean, McClatchy at the top, we mentioned they own newspapers like the Miami Herald. The company is behind some of the country's other top regional papers like the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News are struggling. What's happening there, Ken?
Well, what happens there is what I call ghost newspapers. So Penny has really well identified these news deserts, and they are petrifying. But ghost newspapers, where we have newspapers that still publish but have less and less news in them. They still have the ads, and they have the hearing aids ads and the obituaries for the older reading population, but less and less local news, ghost newspapers.
We're going to get into this a little bit in the next segment, Ken, but like, why are these companies not making money? Is there one reason? Is it that people just aren't buying newspapers anymore?
Number one reason is the outflow of advertising money that has gone to Google and Facebook over the last decade. They control 60% of all the digital advertising in the country, and that's now the main type of advertising.
We've been talking about the collapse of the local news industry, and before we return to that conversation, we've been hearing from you about whether you subscribe to your local newspaper.
I'm Mary from Safety Harbor, Florida, and I do subscribe to the Tampa Bay Times. I subscribe, and I have for years, because I support local newspapers, and I support professional journalism and the ethics that they have and the professionalism that they employ when they report the news. It is an important protector of our freedom and of our democracy.
I'm Rachel Croston, calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I do not subscribe to my local newspaper. I have considered a digital subscription, but honestly, there are a lot of venues to get news for free that I want, but I don't keep up with local news, and maybe I should.
Returning back now to Ken Doctor of Newsonomics and Penny Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the UNC. Penny, we just heard from a couple folks who made some interesting points. One was about the civic duty. People feel that it's their civic duty to subscribe to news. But another, Rachel, our last caller, said, no, I don't want to subscribe. I want to, you know, just watch, get the news I get for free. Tell us a little bit about how that tension is affecting the local news landscape.
There have been two recent surveys that really shed light on what people think about the economic peril of local news and what they think also about the importance to democracy. The first one, done by the Pew Research Center, found that 50% of people noticed they had less local news in their whatever local news outlet they looked at, whether it was television or newspapers, but especially newspapers. But 75% were unaware that there was any economic problems causing that cutback in news coverage. Similarly, only 15% had subscribed to a newspaper in the past year or so. More recently, Gallup just came out with a survey that found that when people were informed about the important role that newspapers especially served in providing the kind of news that feeds our democracy, they were much more likely to donate or subscribe to a newspaper. And also, if they were then given the background of why news was important and why it needed to be supported financially, they were also even more willing to subscribe.
And so far, Penny, we've been talking a lot about newspapers, but what about TV news? And I'm also wondering if you could tell us how public radio is doing. I think NPR affiliates are doing quite well locally, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think that we're going to have to look at a variety of business models going forward. What we've had is a collapse of the for-profit model, especially in communities that are small or economically struggling. And in fact, the typical, as I mentioned before, underrepresented communities. If you have a good, strong owner who's committed to investing in the transformation, because it is really happening very quickly, you can get good news. But I think we're going to have to look at a variety of models where it's nonprofit or whether it's relying more on public funding, especially to cover the underrepresented communities. Regional television has historically done a very good job of covering the metro market on certain areas, but they rarely stray out into the communities at farther out in the state. Roughly 90% of what they have in any given program is devoted to what's happening in the metro area, whether that's weather, whether that's traffic, or whether that and sports, or just good, hard local news.
Ken, to that point, to Penny's point, and we have seen some news organization move toward nonprofit status, most recently the Salt Lake Tribune. We're seeing other news outlets springing up that have sort of a new business models behind them where they're corporate philanthropy. Are there benefits in going in that direction? I mean, aren't you at the mercy of your benefactor at that point?
Well, you are. I mean, no matter who pays, that does determine the news we get. And actually, the one single positive movement of the last decade is that reader revenue, that means us as subscribers, now represent majority of revenue for places like The Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and The Guardian. So that is the positive, and that is working on that national level, and I think that's really important. The idea that nonprofit journalism, unquote, will save us, I think is a false one. There isn't enough philanthropy money to support local media, local news gathering in thousands of communities. It works really well at the national level, and we see it clearly at NPR stations, but also Marshall Project, Kaiser Health, Chalkbeat, all of these specialty sites in criminal justice and education and health, they work well. But I don't think it's the savior locally. I think when you look at it, you say, okay, it's good for you. You know, it's good for civic life, as one of the callers said. And that's one of the reasons we subscribe. The other is product. These were products that did a lot of things for us in our lives when the daily newspapers were in their heyday. They need to do the same thing in the digital form. So it isn't just do good, feel good about it, but can there be products like the modern New York Times and Washington Post that we actually feel are a good deal and worth paying for?
But Ken, you and I talked about this, I think, years ago when I was at the New York Times reporting on media, and the idea that private equity is now something that's in taking over a lot of media outlets. I mean, not everybody can be the New York Times. It's a hard place to compete with. So when we see private equity creeping into journalism, places like Alden Global Capital, for example, what are the benefits or not benefits to that?
Well, there have been very few benefits. Alden Global Capital, which just bought 25% share of the Tribune Company, and that was the last major and seen as negative news of the last week, has just cut and cut and cut. And if you look at this, one of my sources said to me last week, people think the newspaper business is different, but it's just like the waste management business. It's a business on its way down, and we're just milking it. And that's what the financial players like Alden do. They are very cynical. They have a turn out the lights kind of strategy to take out $400 million in the last 4 or 5 years. And then whatever's left, sell it to somebody, maybe a civic group that wants to raise a little money, or turn out the lights.
I mean, we should give some of these local outlets their due here, Penny. We know the Miami Herald reporting really was the reporting that put the spotlight on Jeffrey Epstein. Newsday here in New York on Long Island recently had a big report on endemic racial discrimination in their real estate market. What do we lose, Penny, when these go away?
Well, we lose a lot. Let me put it in perspective. A publisher of a very small weekly in North Carolina who won a Pulitzer Prize for a Public Service Award for taking on the KKK back in the 1950s is very aggressive in his coverage of local government, of officials and the like. But he told me the difference between running at a double-digit margin versus trending toward break-even is that he has to think twice about what he's going to take on, what he's going to champion, where he's going to devote his resources, and whether he can survive a legal challenge. I think that is the untold story about what the damage can ultimately be to our democracy. There's a lack of transparency, a lack of taking on the corruption that will inevitably flourish if you cannot shine a light on it.
Penny Muse Abernathy is Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media at the University of North Carolina, and Ken Doctor is a media analyst and founder of Newsonomics. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.